Hello everyone. Just to give this a little bit of context, it's chapter 10 out of about 35 or 40 or whatever I end up with. Well, that is actually finished, but I might well change it. Of a crime novel set in London. The main character, who is called Slim, is investigating a theft. And I think I'll just take it from there. And I'll take questions afterwards if anyone has any trouble. The gaffer tape over my letterbox was still in place, but wrinkling and peeling a little at the edges. I patted it sympathetically and opened the door to find an empty room that was undisturbed and quiet, with a slightly musty smell to it. One day, I would make the bed in the morning and open a window. It might help. I got a fresh hat out of the wardrobe and headed for the office. My neighbour's Maggie's voice warbled through the door at me while I waited for the lift. She was washing another man out of her hair. If only it were that easy. On the corner of Tavistock and Marchmont, a group of men were putting plasterboard over the tiles in the old fishmongers. I stopped and watched for a moment. The tile work must have been 60 years old and was blue and white, washed out by 100,000 fishy J-cloths. Now it was being covered up and drilled into by yellow plasterboard sheets. One of the guys carrying the sheets from the van stopped. "Snappy snaps," he said cheerfully. "Be open in about a month." I nodded, pulled out a native blend, and lit it while they worked. Just what we needed. There were only 5 photo developing shops between there and Russell Square Tube Station. 5, shortly to be 6, in about 200 yards. There'd only been 1 fishmonger. The butcher's shop had closed the year before, and a tanning parlour had gone in its place. I wondered how long Ashish would hold down the rent on his off-licence and allow me and Eddie to sit upstairs and make fun of each other. Ashish didn't look like a man who was bothered about the rent. As I walked past him on the way up to the office, he was arguing one of the Breakfast Club members. The man on my side of the counter had a face the same colour as a postbox and a case of the shakes that made his teeth rattle. As I passed the open door, I heard his voice whining like an overpaid executive in a fancy restaurant. "But I don't like that sherry. It's too sweet." Ashish played the role of the supercilious sommelier. "That may well be, sir," his voice getting slightly louder, "but it is the only one we have that costs £1.99. I left them discussing the finer points of enology and went up the stairs. Eddie was out doing a funeral that day. He hadn't told me who it was, but he felt the need to be on hand, so it must have been serious. Serious in this case meant money or criminals, and probably both. One of the ways his chauffeur business made money was laying on cars for big family get-togethers, and he knew some big families. The office was hot and dry, like a bad curry. The blinds were drawn and the big window had soaked up the summer sun, warming through the tired cigar smoke and the old tea smell. I opened the blinds on one side of the window to let in some air from the outside. It wasn't any fresher, but at least it was relatively new. As I turned, I saw the red light on the answering machine blinking like an albino mouse. I listened to the message, shut the window, and was down the stairs before the machine had finished rewinding, or wherever it was that it did. The afternoon traffic hadn't quite reached its peak, but it was getting the flag and the camera ready. There would be no point in getting a taxi and sitting in it watching the meter pile up and the same lamppost for 10 minutes at a time. So I found a coin and stepped onto one of the buses that rolled slowly up and down between Gray's Inn and Brixton. It wouldn't be a long journey anywhere else, but in London you move through a lot of neighbourhoods. I shared a tartan seat next to a man with jet black hair slicked straight back from a brown forehead. He wore a nylon shirt with horses on the front, and his throat showed a livid scar right on the Adam's apple. Anyone can get a one-day travel card. Barclay's message on the answer phone had been brief. Something was afoot. Would I meet him in the police pub? I was reluctant to return to the scene of my passing out parade, but I had no way of changing the plan from the top of a bus. We made it to the Elephant and Castle in 15 minutes, which was as good as I could have hoped for. I got off there as the Walworth Road had more lights on it than a Regent Street Christmas. The shops and cafes were getting ready to close, and what crowd there was in the street, waiting for buses or the lights to change. Lots of people stood around holding plastic bags. I made it to the corner of the Rowland Estate in about 10 minutes and turned into the street that led to the pub. As I got close to the place, I could see the small beer garden that Barclay used as his stakeout post. He wasn't there. I walked up to the door of the pub and pushed it open. Nobody burst out laughing or jumped on me. The men sat around the bar, looked like the last bunch I'd seen, but a little bit too casual and a few too many white shirts and black shoes to make the place feel relaxed. I got a few looks, but no muttering as I walked round the bar until I saw Barclay, sitting alone at a table with a nearly empty pint of Guinness and a book. It was a collection of Sherlock Holmes stories. Looking for inspiration? I kept my voice neutral. Barclay looked up from his book and motioned for me to sit down. It wasn't the time for me to get a drink, and I didn't really want one anyway. Barclay tucked the book into his plastic bag and leant forward across the table. His eyes seemed bigger than usual. He spoke in something just above a whisper. I had to lean forward until we were like a couple of engrossed chess players or lovers about to kiss. Barclay's eyebrows signalled in the direction of Simon's flat. Arthur, something is going on in there. Simon, the subject, came home about 2 hours ago in a tremendous hurry. I was sitting in the garden and I heard the slam of his door from there. About an hour after that, a car pulled up right outside the door and somebody went in. Barclay stopped and finished his drink. He looked over the top of the glass and over my shoulder. I swiveled on my chair to see a man in a bow tie and a white shirt approaching my table. Maybe I would have a drink after all. It would be rude not to, and I'd already disgraced myself once in this bar. It wouldn't do to get banned. The barman in the bow tie made a big routine of removing Barclay's glass so I would get the message. I got it loud and clear and got two more pints of Guinness. The wait for the black beer to settle in its glass bothered me, but Barclay bothered me more. If something were happening, shouldn't we be outside keeping our beady eyes on the flat? When the dinosaurs had ruled and given up, the Alps had formed and the Guinness was ready, I hurried back to the table. Barclay, I said, why are you sitting in here? He fussed with his glasses and prodded the head on his beer into little foamy peaks. I'm sorry, Arthur. I fear I have let you down. Barclay bowed his head a little. As I was saying, someone went in and then they left. I saw a car pull up and I saw Simon open the door. He looked rather angry. However, then a brewery dray pulled up right between me and the door to the building. I could hardly run round to see who it was. It's the most damnably bad luck. I smiled grimly. Just when I thought I was getting somewhere, a brewery intervenes. If Barclay saw the gag, he didn't let on. While the barrels were being unloaded, he said, I heard the door slam again. I'm pretty sure it came from his apartment, but as sure as I was the first time. The car drove off in the other direction. I got nothing, Arthur. I saw nothing. He looked more crestfallen than I'd ever seen him, even the time when Lady had beaten him at Scrabble. I took a sip of the Guinness and waited. There had to be more. With Barclay, there always was. Apart from his love of keeping the guessing game going, the dray in the way did not explain why he'd left his post and come inside. He took a drink and grabbed a cigarette from my packet. I offered him a light and he held the fag with one hand as he leant into the flame. I never saw him smoke before and he did it like a beginner, taking little sucks and blowing the stuff out in big puffs. I joined in, cracking the Zippo open with one hand while pulling out a gasper with the other. When it came to the slow death, I wanted to show Barclay I was way ahead of him. But he wasn't troubled by slow death. It was the other kind that worried him. Arthur. After the car had pulled off, I walked to the flat. The main door was locked, so I went to the side where there's a window with a white cotton blind. There's a small gap in the blind, Slim. A gap. His eyes were wider than the Thames barrier, and they looked like they might ship water at any moment. He didn't want to say it. Some people don't. Like the elderly patients in the doctor's waiting room, or the priest who hasn't got the words. Barclay was a logician, an academic, but the reality had him all gummed up. He might have covered all the bases from sun worship to Tibetan Buddhism, but it didn't make him any more able to cope than anyone else. I nodded and drank, while Barclay smoked with greater fury and even less expertise. I'll take a look, I said. You get on home. I felt guilty. This man, my friend, was not meant to see really bad things. Chasing kids round the Trocadero or following shoplifters is what he did for me, not peering through windows and being frightened. He looked terribly disappointed as he put away the last of his beer. His plastic bag rustled forlornly as he stood up. I didn't look round as he left me sitting there. Barclay would keep quiet and still be there for me, but I never wanted to see him looking bewildered again. Bewildered and afraid were things I'd learned to live with. It wasn't fair to pass them on to someone else. I felt a few eyes on me as I placed the glass on the bar. Let them look, I thought. I hadn't broken any laws. At least not yet. The only sound I heard when I left was the door sighing closed behind me. The sun outside was getting lower in the sky over Waterloo and throwing a red cast over the South London brickwork. I could see the window with the white blind from just outside the pub garden. A woman was walking a dog just along from the window on a patch of scrub grass that stretched the length of Simon's building. There was a sign beside it, showing a dog inside a struck-through red circle. Anarchists everywhere. When the dog and the woman had finished improving the environment, I slunk up to the window, watching where I put my feet. Barclay had been right. There was a gap. Through it, I could make out a bare floor, covered in a blonde laminate meant to look like wood. On the fake wood, I could see a flip-flop. It was quite a nice flip-flop. Not one of the cheap ones you get from a seaside stall. You would pay money for this flip-flop, with its logo and snazzy design. The only thing that might put you off was the severed foot still sitting inside it. Thank you.